Welcome back to the Masters of Modern. I'm your host, Andrew Garfield, with my co-host, Ben Bateman. And we are the Spider-Mans of this universe. And we're having a good time. Welcome. This is the second podcast of the new year. This is the first podcast we're recording in 2022. It's the future. It's great. I'm actually Alex Kessler. You should follow me on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, and any service you have at Kess Wiley. And Ben is at Ben Bitney Media. And if you are here for the first time, hit that subscribe and like button. And in a second, we'll do a game of trivia that's just going to stump all of you. And then you're going to give us all the likes that we appreciate. I don't think we deserve them, but we it greatly helps this podcast succeed. And we can't do it without any of your help. And today, just before we get into all of that, we are talking about Kamigawa block, the original one. We're going back in time as we're about to hit Neon Dynasty up and see a whole new slew of a return to a set that was pretty stratifying in popularity. Like, it wasn't the most popular set the first time we come, but has gained popularity over time. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to visit the top 10 cards from this set. We're going to talk some interesting mentions. This is going to be specifically about that in the modern format, but also just its cultural relevance to Magic. Hi, friends. Hi, Ben.
What's up? Yeah, this is going to be a fun episode. So I'm really happy to be back. It's my second episode back on the podcast. Took a couple months off. This is a show where, of course, we talk about the modern format in Magic the Gathering. If you guys don't know, we've been doing this show since 2014. It's our eighth year. It's crazy. Yeah. Craziness. Yeah. And we've been talking about this set for a very, very long time. Classically, the Kamigawa block. Not my favorite block. I was amongst the group of people that had their issues with it.
Were you playing that? So I was not playing Magic when the set came out. And I can talk towards some of the like post-fact stuff, but were you even playing Magic at the time?
I was, yeah. So I didn't play in Standard. Like, I wasn't like a consistent Magic player when this came out. But I think if I remember correctly, Mirrodin's 03. So I think it's 03. So I think this is like 04 is what I'm pretty sure. Because I think Ravnica's 05 maybe. I might be off by like a year.
Sure.
But I think it's right in there. So what I remember is in like 04, I wasn't playing as much. I got back in Time Spiral. So I went to the Champions of Kamigawa pre-release. Like, that I definitely did. I remember. I remember like playing with Bushido and all that. And like, but I didn't play a lot. So I was around during that time. I remember a lot of the cards. You know, it wasn't even that I had the biggest problem with the set at the time, because when a new Magic set comes out and you're investing in the lore and all the mechanics and the way the whole thing works, it's really difficult to evaluate how you're going to feel about these cards down the line when you go back and you compare them to other things from the same time period. You usually just have to sort of accept, like, these people that make these cards are really smart. They know what they're doing. They've put a lot of time into this. So, like, I have to trust that this is probably, you know, better than my experience suggests my first time playing it. What always gets me about Kamigawa is when I go back to the block now, how many throwaway trash commons and uncommons there are that I just want nothing to do with. That's like the...
Well, yeah. So this set is famous for a lot of things, right? One is it was the set just following Mirrodin block, which was historically known as one of the most powerful eras and broken eras in Magic design and Magic Standard history. It was the third lowest... top three most bans in a single year happened during Mirrodin block, and Kamigawa, especially the later two sets, came out in a point where there was time to basically ban cards, right? They lower the power level. So it was like at the time famously underpowered, kind of like the era right now. Like we talked in the last week's episode, if people haven't watched it, kind of went over the like last year in design, and one comment we did have was kind of the power level of 2021 was pretty low compared to the last 2 years, and it's kind of a similar situation where it was a leftward swing from the power level of the previous year, which is now the number one most banned cards in a single year, beating Urza's Saga block. But beyond that, it was also one of the most insularly designed. It leaned on basically like three specific things, being arcane cards, Soul Shift, or pretty specific tribal from Soul Shift with spirits, ninjutsu with ninjas, and Bushido with samurai, which is basically just Rampage, or like not the most exciting mechanic anyways. And then the big one was Legendary Matters, and at that point, Legendary Matters was pretty much exclusively a net negative, like legendary cards. The Commander was not popular. And but when we say not popular, I mean like a few judges were playing it. Sheldon Mennery and friends were like slowly growing it. It was bigger than Highlander Roulette is now, but it definitely was not seeing play anywhere close to its popularity that we see it nowadays.
It started to get its first like boost in as like a national consciousness, where like not a product release to support it, but like it was a couple years after this that people started to play it a little bit more casually, like 05, 06. I think there are some really funny things you can pay attention to when it comes to the design of this set when you really want to point to the power level and where it was at. You know, like a great example is not only so we got a rare 2/2 for one white in Isimaro Hound of Conda. But the funny thing about that is it was a legendary 2/2 for one. They had to make it legendary to justify it being a 2/2 for one. And the idea that it was rare, right, or that it was legendary was like a drawback. So you couldn't play like a second one on turn two.
Well, that one's a famous one, too, right? That was the Mark Rosewater bet where someone was like, you can't make a rare vanilla creature. Someone was basically like, Mark Rosewater, a rare vanilla creature can't be made. And he was like, hold my. I think he doesn't eat bananas, whatever Mark Rosewater drinks. I don't think he's a drinker. But so he really responded and was like, no, you can. And that's where it came from. It's like a legendary 1/1 vanilla 2/2, one mana vanilla 2/2. And one of the most powerful cards for a long time from the set, right? Like that card has seen a ton of play and still sees some play modern as like whenever legendary creatures matter decks come up, right? Like,
well, because Mox Amber pushed, Mox Amber pushed us in the direction of needing to have decent things you could do on turn one that were legendary. And two power on turn one, if it turns on a Mox, is pretty good.
I think now it's fallen off, right? Because you have a bevy of like, especially in red, you obviously have Raghavan, but then you also have
the red guy, the dash guy,
the other red one drop, and you have Kithion, right? Like if you want a white one mana one, so like you have to need 16 copies of one mana legendary creatures, and like you might as well just play Thalia.
Yeah, for sure.
That's like busted at the two drop slot. So like it definitely, I think, has fallen by the wayside. But yeah, I mean, like legendary matters. It also was invented Azfan. So for those who don't know, Azfan is a term in Magic design where it's how often your theme is showing up in a pack. So it's if you open up a pack of this set, will you be able to grok or understand quickly what the theme of the set is? And when every creature is legendary at rare, every rare permanent was legendary in the set. But that's it. Like there were maybe a few uncommons and common ones, no common ones, a few uncommon ones. It really didn't show up very often. So people really didn't get a grasp on, oh, this is a legendary matter set. Now there were a lot of cards that referenced it, but for limited, you were going to get three of them because those are the three rares you open. That's only if you opened up permanents. So it ended up not being the most influential feature to gameplay for what was supposed to be like the first Legendaries Matter set. Now, since then, we've had a few sets that have done Legendary Matters. Specifically, recently was Dominaria was a big Legendary Matters, and they used Historic to kind of get that across. And then most recently, Kaldheim, right? Those were both the last Legendary. And they've very obviously figured out how to do it, right? You put an uncommon legendary creatures in there, you do, you know, cycles of both. I think actually also the Dungeons and Dragons set as the Forgotten Realms had a sub theme of legendary, but it wasn't as big as the other two. So
Matters is something that's pushed a lot more often than design now, just only because we, you know, Commander is such a popular product. The more cool legendary creatures that we have, you know, there's an exciting place to use them and exciting different ways to kind of develop that. So a quick shout to everybody here. We want to give a big thank you to the Nobles of House Modern, everybody who supports our Patreon. That's patreon.com/themmcast. It's the reason that we have a fancy editor that's able to put this episode together for us, or that we're able to continue just doing the show. So thank you guys so much for that. And also, the episode is brought to you by TCG Player. Big thank you to you guys for doing that for us. And we have an affiliate link that, if you guys can see, is listed below.
There's a link below. If you click that, next time you want to buy cards from TCG Player, it helps us out and we super appreciate it. All right. Yeah. And the last thing is, I said that trivia question. I brought it up. There is, and I was wrong, not every permanent was legendary, but every creature was legendary that was at rare. But there is a artifact that costs XX.
Ooh.
In Legends of Kamigawa, in the block, in Kamigawa block.
Okay.
Which set is it in, and what its name is it?
Oh, this is going to be a tough one. All right. I believe it is called Orochi Hatchery. It costs XX, you said?
It does cost XX.
I think it's an artifact called Orochi Hatchery. It's like that snake artifact.
Before you continue, I guess we kind of forgot to tell the rules of trivia. Hopefully people will remember. If this is your first time here, you said that the subscribe button, because you don't get the rules, so you're already going to do it. You have to comment below with what you think the answer is as part of this trivia. And if you get it wrong, you have to hit a like and subscribe and share. But if you get it right, you don't have to do any of those things. You've dodged that bullet. All right.
The question is, which set? Orochi Hatchery. I don't think it's Betrayers. Or what the hell does the champion's logo look like? I mean, one of them is like a lantern, one of them is the ninja star. So then what's the last one? I feel like it's the lantern. God, which one is champions is the question. Brutal. I think Orochi Hatchery is in the lantern one. Which I just, is it in Champions of Kamigawa?
That would be, the lantern one is Saviors of Kamigawa.
Damn it!
Orochi Hatchery is in Champions of Kamigawa, though.
Well, there you go. I locked my way into it.
It's the Archway Gate is the set.
Right, of course it's the Archway. I knew that. I had it in my mind. But, well, I'm glad my instinct still got me the right answer. You don't sign off. You want to dock me points.
I'm going to dock. You're going to have to hit that like and subscribe button, Ben. And then everyone else, if you got it right, we will like your comment and comment on how great you did eventually. But thank you for everyone. And if you got it right and want to hit that like button, we appreciate that as well. All right. So these are the cards that did not make the list when it comes to the top 10 cards in Kamigawa history in the set for Modern. Tribe, Sakura Tribe Scout, Arayo Soritami Ascendant, Kami of the Crescent Moon, Kitaki's War Wage, Kira Great Glass Spinner, Maga the Trader of Mortals, Ninja of the Deep Hours, Goto Bandit Warlord, Glimpse of Nature, Sensei's Divining Top, Blazing Shoal, Disrupting Shoal, Nourishing Shoal, Peer Through Depths, Time of Need, Umezawa's Jite, Footsteps of the Goryeo, Freed from the Real, Ghostly Prison, Threads of Disloyalty, Ayajanjo Castle, Forbidden Orchard, Hall of the Bandit Lord, Mikakoro, Center of the Sea, Minamo, School of Water's Edge, Shinka, the Blood-Soaked Keep, Shinzo, Death Storehouse, and Untadake, the Cloud Keeper. And the reason I wanted to read those off, now, some of those got kicked off because they were banned.
I got so happy as you got towards the complicated land names.
I think I did an okay job.
You did a pretty good job.
None of the banned cards are on the list, right? There, surprisingly, a lot of cards from this set were banned. And we kind of talked about it. The power level was low from a design perspective, but over time, I think actually the power level has creeped up or been more appreciated. I think that
there's four cards on the list you just described that are banned, right?
Mm-hmm. And a ton of the cards I named have seen a ton of modern play. You know, Sakura Tribe Scout has seen a ton of play. Kitaki the War Wage, Kira Glassbinner, you know, most of the lands to some extent have seen decent play as well.
Speaking of a land that you didn't name that is not in our top 10, Boseiju Who Shelters All. That's another one that's really close that did not make our top 10. That's seen a lot of play. I mean, I think looking at this list of cards, you know, you have cards like Kitaki War's Wage or Disrupting Shoal that have really been major players. The four banned cards, for anybody wondering, are right when the format became legal. They had already banned Glimpse of Nature, Umezawa's Jite, and Sensei's Divining Top. So those have all three been banned since the inception of Modern. It's been 10 years now since Modern, and none of those have ever been legal, but they banned Blazing Shoal in the first year because you could pitch a, you know, 10 mana cost big creature to infect somebody out on turn two. And I think now, like, I don't think it would be backbreaking, but it would make Modern less fun that was something available that you could do, because it would just mean that you had to be prepared to not lose to that. So I think it would be kind of, we've talked about this on episodes before, but those four are all
GTA is the like wild card people come at me with, like, I'm banning that card. I'm like, no,
so
like
good.
It doesn't do anything healthy for the format right now. An equipment deck is probably the best card in the format. Maybe if Stoneforge Mystic wasn't legal. And even then, I think Stoneforge Mystic being legal is way more interesting than GTA being available.
People just don't remember because I will always say that I think Jite is like on the line because it's so expensive. I've tried to argue for unbanning it before, but what people don't remember about Jite is that at the end of the day, when somebody has an active Jite against you and you are a deck that suffers against it, it's the least fun experience in the world. There's nothing fun about that. It feels stupid. It feels like this stupid way, this workaround that they figured out where you're like, well, but it's like a minus thing. So like indestructible doesn't matter. And like protection doesn't matter. And you just keep refilling and the counters stay on it. Even if I kill the creature it's on. So like my one hope of like, maybe like, you know, drawing some flying creature that can get around, like, yeah, good luck. Your Brazen Borrower is going to be dead the second you cast it. There's no chance. You have no shot here.
Yeah, I think it would be pretty oppressive in a way that already the format's having trouble with. Like, that's the argument people make, right? Is like, it can't be that bad. Like, it's not like there isn't such a bevy of good removal spells that like creatures playing X1s don't see a lot of play anyways. And I think like how much worse is Jite than Fury is like, I guess, the real question to ask. And I do think the cost on Fury versus the difficulty in working around a Jite is really the issue for me.
I mean, Fury requires you to play red cards, right? Jite doesn't.
There's no good red cards in Modern right now.
Well, then, I think it's funny that I use the example of Brazen Borrower because, like, obviously the front half of Brazen Borrower can just bounce Jite, but, like, still, the point still stands. But even, like, you know, you think about all the cards. You think about, like, Dragon's Rage Chandler, like, cards where you're like, this Chandler itself is going to maybe be able to draw me into an answer to not lose this game. Like, cast, it's dead. It's dead anything.
To me, it's not even those, because like there's an argument that that's why to unban it, right? Like being able to more handily have answers to Dragon Rage Chandler, Raghavan, and friends is like a good thing, right? I think to me, the thing that is it like really destroys, like Infect is never a good deck again, right? Like, and you have decks like anyone playing either of the Hierarchs, Noble Hierarch or Ignoble Hierarch, just like kind of take a bath. And Jite also is a really hard permanent to get rid of because it like fits right into Lurrus decks. It like, to me, it gives Hammer decks even more versatility in the ability to sustain, remove creatures, as well as get in bigger threats in a way that I think is just very unhealthy for the format.
You guys can hear us. We have a whole conversation sometime in the last 6 months. We did a whole episode about cards that could come off the ban list. I think it was in the last 6 months. So we have a whole conversation about each of those cards. But those four that are on the list, none of those are in consideration. There was a few on this list that got close. I think for me, the ones that really stand out on this list that really are like very, very strong. Disrupting Shoal has had a lot of play over Modern's history. It's never been dominant and there are better options now. But it saw a good amount of play. Nourishing Shoal is another one that was part of a pretty big deck.
The fact that the cards needed to make Nourishing Shoal work are now banned makes it not making the list, right? Simian Spirit Guide needs to be legal to make Grishul brand decks work, but Nourishing Shoal saw a ton of play in that deck specifically, and other cards from that have made the top 10.
For sure. Igonjo Castle is a card that has seen play in Modern since the very beginning of the format. Yeah. It's always a solid card. I mean, it works well with Raghavan. Like, it's just a good card.
To me, the two cards I probably played the most on this list are Threads of Disloyalty, which I think is just like fallen out of favor as a sideboard card. But for like the first 5 years of Modern was like a big deal as one of like better sideboard options. But then Ghostly Prison. And that's obvious, like in Commander, I think if this was a including Commander or just like historic standard formats or whatever, I think Ghostly Prison would be maybe in the top five. Then some of these unbanned cards come off as well. Because it's in Modern, it's seen pretty limited play and pretty niche like Enchantress decks, really, and Prison decks. And even then hasn't seen a lot of play. Doesn't make it on the list, but like I think I've cast Ghostly Prison more times than half the cards on the top 10.
I mean, Ghostly Prison, yes, it's a mainstay staple. I think the really interesting stuff about this block, you know, and we're going to talk about some of this as well in the top 10, but like, you know, the cycle of rare lands, we named a lot of them, are a really interesting cycle, specifically the ones that come into play untapped, create a colored mana, and then have the ability to affect a legendary creature. They're very strong, right? Like untapped lands, an untapped land that produces colored mana that has a good ability is like, there's very little downside to playing it other than getting like Blood Mooned out or something. But I mean, all of them, Shizo, Shinka, Obviously, Igonjo Castle, they all kind of do something decent, right? Whether it's giving it fear, giving a creature first strike, preventing two damage. There's value to all of those ideas.
Like, lands with abilities, regardless. There has never been a cycle of lands with abilities that haven't seen some amount of modern play, right? Like, from the ability lands from Zendikar that enter the battlefield and do something, from Bujuku Bog being the one that's seen the most play there, to the rare ones where Valakut sees play, to the tap lands from Innistrad block. Like, anytime we put like Besiju and Hall of the Bandit Lord, both of those have seen play in modern. It's not like those decks cards are not modern played cards. They're often more niche, but to all the untapped ones, I mean, both of the blue untapped ones have seen play in Merfolk since day one as like choke or other anti-island tech backup plans. They're a free roll. It's free to play them.
Yeah, and I think it leads us nicely. We can go back to referencing some of these cards we mentioned here, but I think it leads us nicely into actually our number 10 on the list, because you just mentioned it a second ago. We can start with that. And our number 10 is actually Oboro Palace of the Clouds. It is one of the two blue untapped legendary lands. Now, the reason this one makes our top 10, and none of the others do, there's a couple reasons. Number one, this card is an untapped blue source. It's a very interesting card because its ability is to tap one, it's one colorless mana to return it to your hand, but it taps itself to add one blue, and it comes in untapped. So it has this built-in function to avoid land destruction, to get around things like choke, and also to trigger landfall. Like, it's one of the only lands that exists where you can play it untapped, get colored mana, and also return it to your hand to keep replaying it if you want to. It's not like the bounce lands from the original Ravnica block, where they come into play untapped unless you have something to, you know, like, this is just an untapped blue source on turn one. You can play this in a deck with Serum Visions on turn one as well as some, you know. So I think Oboro is an interesting card. It's one of the most expensive lands in modern.
Yeah, it's like $90, right?
Yeah. Foil is like almost $400.
Now, I do think the biggest thing here is its ability. I do think, like, the most important piece is its ability to just be in a Merfolk deck or in a mono blue deck and allow island based decks to be able to have some resistance to choke, right? Like, that's the, like, first step is I can play these cards in this deck and I won't get blown out. The backup side, though, is there are other use cases, and that's, I think, where this card, especially between the two, and the reason I put this one above the other one, in the long run has the potential to see play in other formats where you do want landfall triggers, or you do want to play effects that, like, you want to have less lands than your opponent. Like, if they ever print land tax into modern, like, this is a great card to, like, have with that card, because you can return it to your hand to draw three. And one thing I do have a card, like, do you think? So we're going to Kamigawa. We're going back to Kamigawa. And that's, like, I do want to talk towards that a little bit at the end. Do you think we're going to get, like, I think this is one of the more iconic things. Do you think we're going to get more untapped lands in this set?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we've said this for years, but, like, Magic's most successful and also Magic's most detrimental designs are always on the edge of pushing power. It's always a place where they're trying to find a clever way to make something exciting and powerful. And sometimes that goes too far. We've seen that plenty of times. But sometimes it works really well. And you'll see a card, like, the great example of a card is like Boseiju Who Shelters All. The downside of Boseiju is pretty down. Like, that's a pretty rough card to play. Now, when it works, it's a great card, right? Boseiju, for those who don't remember, is, it's like a tapped land that when it taps to add colorless mana, that colorless mana allows you to cast a spell. That spell can't be countered. It's got a really cool use case. It's one of the very, very few lands.
You lose two life.
Yeah, it's like a very detrimental card, but it's a very unique card. So I think Boseiju is a great example of a card where, like, they could probably push a version of Boseiju that's a little more playable than this Boseiju, just slightly. Like, that's probably an exciting type of card for us to see, maybe an updated version. I could see them making some powerful untapped lands. We just had a lot more untapped lands, though, since. I mean, when I brought up Oboro in the first place, your answer was, like, there's just way more of them now. It's less of a special card than it used to be. And so I think the space they can play in with untapped lands that produce colored mana, similar to, like, we're getting more artifact lands now. We're getting, like, different versions of artifact lands now. They're more willing to do that than they used to be.
Absolutely. All right. So the next card, and this is a kind of another, like, you know, in the top 10, like the not the deepest cut, but the next one is an arcane card of all things, is Through the Breach, and that's 5 mana. You may put a creature card from your hand onto the battlefield. This creature gains haste. Sacrifice that creature at the beginning of the next end step, and you can splice it to arcane for 2 red, which, for those who don't know, because this mechanic is rarely relevant, if you have an arcane card, you can spend, and you cast an arcane card, if you have a splice to arcane card in your hand, you can spend 2 red to cast it, but it stays in your hand. You basically copy this spell and attach it to the spell that you're playing. Now, I do think, because we got a splice onto instants and sorceries card, like splice doesn't have to hit arcane spells. They could just hit anything. We got a splice to instants and sorcery card in Modern Horizons 1. I think we're going to get splice back. I think we're going to get splice back, especially because Champions or Kamigawa Neon Dynasty like is doing the whole futuristic, the cyberpunk aesthetic, and like hackers are such an integral part to that experience. And splicing is like, I can't think of a more
right. Hackerish,
you know, like yeah, warding and feeling. And it is a key part of the Kamigawa block. And it's something that they have recently figured out how to do. It's not parasitic. It was bad the first time because it's really parasitic when you're doing splice onto arcane, when it has to be weird arcane spells that you play with in this weird tribal way. All of these cards end up being useless, or you have to play with pretty mediocre arcane cards.
Do you think
make it splice onto instants, or splice onto creatures, or splice onto enchantments, or splice onto artifact? Like, those are all abilities you can do that like could work.
Do you think that in new Kamigawa they utilize blockchain technology?
No. No. I hope not. The blowback will be bad. I think there's a chance a secret layer-esque type of situation happens like that, but I don't think that we're going to see that anytime soon.
the crypto Kamigawa. Through the Breach brings me back to the beginnings of Modern. There are certain cards that have such a special place in my heart because I just remember them being so important in the first few years. And Through the Breach is one of those cards. It's not quite as significant of a card as it used to be. It does still pop up. There'll be decks that take advantage of it.
Yeah.
They haven't pushed a better version of it really, like very hard. There isn't like a strictly better Through the Breach yet.
Right. At least in Modern, right? Like there is.
Yeah.
Through the Breach is a reference to Sneak Attack, right? But and Nahiri does it as a back end, and that's where it's seen play, right? It sees play as a win condition in Jeskai control lists on occasion, as a pretty powerful way to win that way. And then it also will see play in Goryeo's Vengeance based reanimator decks as a backup plan to do the Grizzlebrand thing. And right now it's a little bit behind, partially because Simeon Spirit Guide got banned. But if we get any type of way to produce free mana with treasures, I think that's even more possible than ever before. Like, I could see I would love to see a tapped land that makes a treasure. I think that would be cool. it enters the blade tapped, but make a treasure. I think that this is a card that in the long run has potential to be really powerful and will continue being that until they print something better. And if we see Arcane come back, which I would be very surprised by, I can see it seeing maybe a little bit of a bump. But I think more likely just the fact that you can cheat Emrakul in the play with it is going to be a cool win condition where, like, if Nahiri is good, Through the Breach becomes much better because you get it as Nahiri's 5 and 6. If you happen to draw your Emrakul, you can use it to cheat in the play, and it's just like a great instant speed win condition to kill your opponent.
Well, that card you just described sounds like a sweet card. It also sounds maybe a little too powerful. A land that comes into play and just accelerates you to 3, and you don't have to do anything other than just play a land in your deck.
But it's tapped. It's tapped lands.
I realize that, but I mean, so you can either cast your thing on turn 1 with your extra mana, or you can not use the treasure. And then you just get to 3 mana on turn 2 for just playing a land. You get a
tapped, colorless producing land that creates a treasure.
I'm saying I think that's too good. Because the downside to that land is there is no downside. It's just a land that produces a colored mana for you on turn 1. But then if you don't use the colored mana, you just have 3 mana on turn 2. Like, the upside is insane, right?
Yeah.
It seems I don't know about that. All right.
I don't think it's better than Birds of Paradise. Or Llanowar or Elf.
It is, though.
No. Llanowar Elf is better.
Neither of those cards can, like, both of those cards require you to spend your turn to put the thing into play, right? Like,
well, so does that. I mean, you one mana to put it in.
I guess it's true. But, like, they also are cards in your deck. They're not lands, right? You have to draw them. Like,
yeah. I think it's different.
It's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea. It's a cool idea. If we see that in a set at some point, Alex called it. Our number eight on the list, another OG spell. It's another spell I've cast this a one million seen more, times.
Yeah, this one, though, I've seen a pretty much wider degree of play and still sees decent amount of play now, and that is
Gifts Ungiven. Classic OG, blue, 3, instant. Search your library for 4 cards with different names. Reveal them. Your opponent chooses 2 of those cards, put those cards in your graveyard, put the rest into your hand, up to 4 cards. That's how it works.
And this has been a staple of the format since Modern existed. It was seen play in control decks originally. Then it was actually seen play in reanimator decks where you would fail to find. So the cards that your opponent choose have to go to the graveyard. So if you only find 2 cards with it because you just couldn't find 2 other cards, they're not in your deck, I guess, due to the rules of how searching works. Your opponent has to pick the 2 cards you picked and put in your graveyard. And if you find Umbrellarites and Elishnorn or Umbrellarites and Iona, you can just lock your opponent out of the game. And so that was always like one of the like cute win conditions out of
Gifts Control and Tron.
Yeah,
and
Esper Reanimator decks, which is cool. And
yeah, well, and it also worked really, really well for your curve because you would like end of turn. You would like end of turn,
their turn on turn 4, cast it, and then untap and be able to do the reanimate and do it at a time that's at the worst position for your opponent. And that's your like main case scenario. You could always use it in the classic Gifts Ungiven value engine way if your opponent just like wouldn't be dead to one of your animated targets, of just like finding your 4 best pieces of removal or 4 lands with different names if you need lands, or you know, Snapcaster Mage, Path, Mana Leak, Remand, and then like they're just like, okay, you're gonna get to do this no matter what.
They've done years of trying to rip this card off and try in terms of trying to make other cards feel like this card. Like they've done so many different versions for different types of cards. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's interesting is they're never as satisfying as Gifts. And then on top of that, Gifts Ungiven is such a great teaching card for a new player. Because if you don't, it's like it's a confusing card if you don't know how to use it properly. Like it's like I've confused the hell out of myself using Gifts over the years. It took me a long time before I finally started like being like, okay, if I cast this in this deck, like I need to have a gifts package B, like know how to do this so that I don't just sit there tanking trying to figure out what to do. Because often when I've tried tanking, I just get like outsmarted by myself, you know?
Right. It is one of the most fun cards I've ever cast. Maybe in all of Magic, right? Like it is such a for those who don't watch, I mean, recommend Rhystic Studies. Sam, he does a YouTube channel. They just released a video kind of talking about Rhystic Studies, talking about Gifts Ungiven. So I recommend checking that video out. Rhystic Studies is a channel. Gifts Ungiven was the video. He's one of my favorite YouTube channels in general. So I definitely recommend checking him out and subscribing to him as well. The main use for Rhystic, we haven't even talked about it. The main use of Gifts Ungiven in Modern is in Storm and has been for like 5 years. And that's where it's like bonkers, because that is a deck that wants all of the cards that do basically all the exact same thing and wants them in their graveyard as much as they want it in their hand.
And I don't know if they're still doing it. I think they are. But also Past in Flames, which has flashback, is like, It's that thing where it doesn't matter if it's in your hand or in your graveyard, because you have multiple different versions of so many different cards. You have 2 rituals that do the same thing, multiple blue 1 mana cantrips. Like you can kind of construct your 4 cards with Gifts to basically be the exact same 4 all the time.
And for them, it reads as an instant speed, end of your opponent's turn, draw 4. That then when you untap, if your opponent does not have interaction, you win. Right. That's what it allows Storm to do, is it gives you this ability to find the exact cards you need. No matter what choice your opponent makes, it's probably going to be a bad one for the reasons you just mentioned. And there you go. You now have a instant speed way to hold up removal or hold up interaction for your opponent on their turn, to then on your turn draw 4 cards, putting Storm so far ahead in card advantage that they need to be able to win the game.
Yeah, I love Gifts. What's the green one that they put into Rise of the Eldrazi? Is it called Realms Uncharted? Is that the name of it? I've tried to use it.
Realms Uncharted. I use it in Commander all the time. That's like one of my first things to add to a green deck. Well, I love lands that do stuff, and like it's not the thing there is just like you're never gonna have the right combo pieces, but being able to get like you know, Wasteland Strip Mine, Dust Bowl, and Ghost Quarter is like a fun way to make something.
A foil really of that card ended up being foil of that card is $30 now. Who saw that coming?
Yeah, I'm not that surprised. That card
was such at a trash rare when you and I met during that set at All Star Cards. That was a trash rare because
I will say that's a card that, like, if we get more, like, Wizards is definitely more willing, especially with the new legendary rule change, to print more and more powerful lands, and that card just gets better and better every year. Next card,
number 7 card. It's a black card. It's an instant. It's Gorya's Vengeance.
For a long time, the best reanimator spell in the format by like a wide margin. Right now, you know, especially these first 4 in the category, these have all fallen a little bit by the wayside due to Modern Horizons, but it historically was the main engine for Grizzlebrand based combo decks, either Grizzlebrand decks, which used Gorya's Vengeance, Grizzlebrand, and Borgamos to create a insane draw cards, discard lands, instant win package that could win on turn 2. I think they even can pull off a turn 1 win, but now with Faithless Looting and Simeon Spirit Guide, that deck no longer really works. Or just classic Gorya Vengeance decks, which was just like, I play on turn 3, I get a Grizzlebrand in the play or an Emrakul in the play, and I can swing with it that turn. Good luck from now on.
Now, just to be clear, obviously Grizzlebrand's the big one over the years that it's been used with. But when Emrakul hits the yard, the trigger goes on the stacked reshuffler, right? So you can Gorya's Vengeance target Emrakul, or you can't when it's in the graveyard.
You can do it in response. So Emrakul hits the graveyard, the effect goes on the stack, and you can Gorya's Vengeance to get it back. The fact that Gorya's Vengeance is an instant is its key.
Is the key functionality.
For this day is still probably worth, you know, looking at.
I haven't played against a Gorya's Vengeance deck in so long that I honestly couldn't remember. And I couldn't remember if, like, there was some stipulation on Emrakul because of its protection from colored spells that prevented it from being targeted in a graveyard. But I think that's only active when it's on the battlefield, correct?
Yeah. Now, I think this is a deck that, you know, especially like going into Esper, like there might be a weird Grizzlebrand, Unbarrel Rites, Gifts Ungiven, Faithful Mending, Gorya's Vengeance, Persist combo deck. Like there's still a reason that like legendary creature, like the reason that Persist doesn't let you hit legendary creatures is because the best reanimation targets are legendary, and Gorya's Vengeance does do that. So like getting Elesh Norn, getting Grizzlebrand, getting Iona, these are still like back-breaking abilities. And you even have stuff like the new Priest of the Fell Rites, right? The 2-mana. You can tap and sack it to reanimate a thing at instant speed. So like those, plus if you find ways to put stuff in your graveyard, stuff like Gamble, or not haggle on the back
the,
end
yeah,
of
the adventure
one, like there's probably a library of stuff you can do in the format to make that deck work. Is that better than just straight up reanimating an Archon of Cruelty? I don't know, but the right creature is printed, or the right ability to combo with Grizzlebrand in the right way, and we're back to looking at Through the Breach, Grizzlebrand, Gorya's Vengeance decks being really powerful, because they are explosive. They do kill you on turn 3.
And also Gorya's Vengeance being as good as it is, it's probably worth noting this is a card that I expect to have very real world application with this new set coming out, because there is going to continue to be more of a Legendary Matters theme. They'll probably print some massive, gigantic, legendary, insane thing that will be very good with Gorya's Vengeance in this set.
Like, or even the next set, right? Like we and Strixhaven added the dragons. Like there's a bunch of different stuff you can do with Gorya's Vengeance that I think is maybe not even being visited right now. The next card, Sakura Tribelder.
The OG. What do people call
Steve?
Steve, right. Yeah. Steve. Because Sakura Tribe
Elder. It's Sakura Tribe Elder value engine.
Value engine. Yeah, so Steve. This guy, green 1 for a 1/1 creature with the old school ability of sacrifice Sakura Tribe Elder, search a library for basic land card, put it on the battlefield tapped.
Importantly, this card does not need to tap. And still is maybe the best Rampant Growth effect in the format, and by a wide margin.
And also classic. So this is we're gonna go way back now for those listeners who were not around during this time. Back when the rules changed and damage was no longer able to be put on the stack, cards like this, cards that stick like a big kick in the pants, because it used to be you could block with your 1/1 Sakura Tribelder, put the 1 damage from blocking or being blocked on the stack, and then sacrifice it for its ability after that 1 damage was applied. They got rid of that, which makes way more sense. But for years and years, cards like Mog Fanatic and Tribe Elder were always used in situations like that.
And the fact that this card has continued to be relevant, even with that nerf, is significant, right? Like the fact that this is in Scapeshift decks, like we're now seeing a resurgence of Bring the Light Scapeshift decks in the format just because Valakut decks are really good when combo linear decks get worse due to Grixis control being better or Grixis Death Shadow being better. Classic rock, paper, scissors, and Valakut being so good against Grixis Shadow decks because their life total getting so low makes it really, really easy to just like bolt, Valakut trigger twice. You lose. but the fact that these cards are so good at fogging opponents' Tarmogoyfs, fogging opponents' Death Shadows for value, right? You're able to play this two drop, block your opponent's attacking creature on the ground, and then get the land you need on your next turn to be ahead is so valuable for two mana. Plus, like, if you don't need the land or you want to hold them back so that when you have Valakut in play, you want to get those mountain triggers, you just attack with them. They're still just like 1/1s that do damage. I've lost to 3 Sacra Tribe Elders, like me having counter magic for their scape shifts and their Bring the Lights, and them, and so like letting them get their Sacra Tribe Elders because like the lands aren't going to do anything. And they're just like, I'll just beat down with these 3 1/1s. And your life total is now at 6, and I have 2 lightning bolts, and you can counter these, and then I win with Scapeshift, or you lose.
It is funny. I mean, obviously, a 1/1 is a much more embarrassing way to lose the game, but I can't tell you the number of times I've lost to a Snapcaster Mage to just like a 2/1 on the ground, right? Like that, I'm like, all right, well, you got your Snapcaster, and I like exiled the card from your graveyard in response to you trying to cast it, or you know what I mean, or.
And in Valakut decks, the 1/1 doing damage is extra. And Snapcaster Mage sees play in those decks too, right? For the same reason, is that they need to get a player to preferably, you know, 15 or less life, right? Or is it, it's 16?
18.
Less it's 18.
Yeah, well, it's 18 first, or less because yeah, six, or six less. Triggers go mountains 2 through 7, right? So you
get 6 triggers. It's 18. So they need to get you the 18 less. And so like decks can just not take the 2 damage somehow, right? They just like aren't playing fetch lands or they play correctly to keep them out of range. And Sacra Tribe Elder is there to do those that really important 2 damage to get it through. And then you win. Yeah. Like they're that the 1/1 status attacking abilities of Sacra Tribe Elder is not to be underappreciated for sure.
Agreed. It's a classic. I mean, I would say there's an argument that the most iconic card on this entire list is Sacra Tribe Elder. It's like there's like a world in which you could convince me that Steve is the number one card on this list.
Yeah. Right. Especially when you bring Commander in, right? Like this is similar to Ghostly Prison. And in fact, like this is the only card on the entire list of cards in this top 10 that I've cast more than Ghostly Prison. Right. And it's just because he's so good in Commander and other formats, especially in decks like Marin, where it's like the best, it's one of the best cards in Marin because you can use it to ramp and you can bring it back with Marin and it gives you the experience counters immediately. Like it's like exactly what that deck wants. But
I haven't seen a deck in Modern combine Lurrus and Tribe Elder. And now I'm thinking about it. It seems like a very, very, very good thing to be doing, right?
The only issue is just what are you ramping to right now? Like, theoretically, Scapeshift could just do that. You could play a black, like a black, green, red, like a Jund Scapeshift deck. That's like
there's only permanents, right? That the Lurrus thing is permanents have to cost 2 or less. Yeah,
permanents have to cost 2. So Scapeshift is fine. You don't get Primeval Titan. Like you're sacrificing Primeval Titan for this, which seems a lot worse. But yeah. There was an era where Primeval Titan wasn't a guaranteed go to in Scapeshift decks, so it's not totally out of the question. Like what does Lurrus get beyond that though? Like other than Sacra Tribe Elder, all the other ramp cards are like instants and sorceries.
Yeah.
Now, like in a Jund deck, just like playing a single Sacra Tribe Elder, knowing that you have like all of the things we just discussed, and knowing that you have Lurrus and being able to bring it back in Zoomer Jund might just be the like a cool secret tech to like outland your opponents. It could be cool.
Yeah. What if there's some sort of cool, more like landfall-esque deck that the Jund that would want to do that? Because like obviously, I mean, I know there are some Jund versions that take serious advantage of that. We've seen obviously the ones that have played what's his name, Tireless Tracker, and like a huge number. Like so, there's definitely some that take advantage. So,
Tireless Tracker does not work with Thuros though. You have to play 2-drop landfall creatures.
So you can't. Yeah. So you can't do it. You can't do it with Tireless Tracker. It's like a separate idea then. Yeah, well, it's certainly an interesting idea. Just something cool that came to mind. Our next card, another classic, another old school relic, a classic car, so to speak. Kiki Jiki Mirror Breaker, the OG Mythic Red. Is there a part of you that's kind of sad that now that Ragavan's so good, that Kiki Jiki will no longer be the face of Red Mythics?
No.
You're like thrilled because it's like was such a stupid red mythic after a certain number of years.
Kiki Jiki is dope. First off, it was printed at Rare originally. Fun fact. Second off, like the fact that for 10 years of mythics being printed, the only mythic rare red cards that were relevant were like cycle red cards. So stuff like Urabrask and Inferno Titan or Kiki Jiki, or like the fact that like in Modern Masters 2 and 3, the best red mythic they can come up with was like Comet Storm is like a joke, right? But when you was back terrible, then when you looked at it, it was like, oh, of the sets available, there isn't a mythic red card that is good other than Kiki Jiki, and they had to upshift that. Like,
and it's almost like Ragavan will never get banned now because they're so excited to have an iconic red mythic.
It does help. I mean, it might get banned, right? Like, it is Deathrite Shaman-esque, but at this point, and I've said I'm more on this on the record every day, I think that Ragavan is less and less likely to be banned. I think, like, A, there's an argument that Dragon Range Channeler is better than Ragavan. B, it, like, isn't dominating the format as much as you would think, and the format is changing around it. And even if you got rid of it, it's not like it fixes the Horizons modern issue of like too many Modern Horizons cards are expensive. It just means like Solitude would be the new $90 card. I think it's going nowhere. But regardless, I'm excited that there's a much, again, there's, you know, literally after Modern Masters 2 came out, Thundermaw Hellkite got printed and Duretti got printed. Like, there's now a library of mythic red creatures they could have printed instead. But at the time, it was just Kiki Jiki. And like,
and in those days, by the way, when those sets were coming out, Kiki was iconic because Kiki was actually played. That's why reason Kiki's number 5 on our list is because Kiki was a relevant card. Like,
and
Kiki
it is now, right? Like, it hasn't lost its relevancy. The fact that Goblin's deck, like the Snoop Goblin deck, is like a tier 2 deck, and it's like a key part of winning with Snoop in play, keeps it relevant. The moment that Birthing Pod gets unbanned, Kiki Jiki becomes a relevant card in the format.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. Like, Kiki Jiki was initially in the old days of Modern. It was part of the Twin package. Then when Twin got banned, Kiki became the Twin package. Then that wasn't good. So then people started playing the Kiki Angel Pod decks, and Pod got banned. So, like, Kiki's been part of a lot of decks that have been banned over the years, and it's an interesting card. I mean, it's a unique card.
Yeah, and Kiki Pod has always been like, right? Like, it was always, there were two pod decks. There was Kiki Pod, which was this glass cannon deck that if you were able to stop the pod from winning, they like couldn't actually really do anything. But if you couldn't stop it, they instant won no matter what, as long as they had two creatures in play. Or you had the Malera combo decks, which were much more of like, oh no, actually I'm a Hate Bears deck, mid-range deck that's just going to beat you down and accidentally I'm going to win. Like, it played very similar to what Splinter Twin was doing, right? They both had like, Splinter Twin was a tempo deck that accidentally would just kill you with combo, and therefore you could never trust it to untap because you could always just die, and therefore it was able to tempo you out. And Birthing Pod was a mid-range deck that did the same thing, where it just like beat you down with random mid-range Hate Bears, but then if you like didn't respect your removal and hold it for the combo, they would just combo out and win you if you tapped out. And like, that was what that era of Magic was, and Kiki Jiki was a big feature kind of to both of that era, and now it's just continued as this kind of like unique combo piece that'll always come up and be relevant.
Yeah, Kiki's biggest drawback always was and always has been the fact that it's triple red and costs 5. It's the casting cost combination of the triple red and the 5 has always been the thing. It's so interesting because it's like if Kiki cost triple red 1 and was a 1/1, it would be better. But how much better?
It would be banned.
You think if it cost 4 and was a 1/1 for triple red 1? Interesting. Yeah, I guess it's true because Splinter Twin costs 4. I guess my point is more just, I think the fact that
it's a Splinter Twin that you can have Cavern of Souls and or play any like creatures gain indestructible this turn to protect it effects, which is
because the power and toughness is totally irrelevant,
right? You can't like, yeah. I think that if it was I think the interesting change that maybe doesn't get it banned is 3 red red I don't think you can go. If you go down in a mana, it's banned. It's Splinter. It's more powerful than Splinter Twin, in my opinion.
What if it was just quadruple red? Quad red.
Ooh. I think it is still bannable, but it is closer to the line. I think it's bannable, especially now still with Snoop, right? Like with it just being a combo deck and other pieces.
Yeah.
I think that five mana is like this perfect sweet spot to make it okay. I agree that the triple red makes it a little less good than I would like, and the only thing you could do is make it three and two red, or you could maybe do maybe like one red, white, green, or like red, white, blue.
Maybe. Yeah, but it's a goblin. I mean that you can't, because that wouldn't, you know, then it wouldn't be like the red goblin. I mean Kiki's high on this list. It was honestly the most contentious card in our ranking. Like, there was an argument that I wanted to try to make to put Kiki at one because it was so iconic, and then there's also an argument that Kiki drops super far down because it's been a while since it's been relevant. But I mean, it continues to be at least moderately relevant. Now, on the flip side, our number four card, another red card. This is funny because this card is like the actual most irrelevant card on this entire list in a lot of ways, but you can't make this list without putting it on here. Like, you just would be ridiculous not to put this on here. So our number four card is Lava Spike. It's another, and Lava Spike is, it's just one red, famously an arcane spell, one red sorcery. Lava Spike deals three damage to, is it target opponent?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not your opponent. It has to target. It's like, I remember when Lava Spike was printed, and I remember
it is now target player or planeswalker due to the rule change.
I remember reading this card when it was first printed and thinking, this card sucks. like I've been playing Lightning Bolt since I started playing Magic. That card's good. This card's terrible. And like, it's really funny that the barometer for what they're willing to print over the years, while it's changed, there isn't just a strictly better Lava Spike. Like, there is, it's called Lightning Bolt, but like, there isn't just like a strictly better or like the same card as Lava Spike. They didn't functionally reprint it. They've always come up with weird like variations on it, other versions, similar cards. But it's not that good of a card. The rate has been repeated so many times in so many ways for either one red or double red in some way. And the burn decks always end up playing Lava Spike. They always come back to it because, like, you just want to have three damage for one red. Like, that's the math, you know?
Yeah, right. And yeah, it's just like, it's when we were making the list, it was kind of like, is Lava Spike number 10? Is Lava Spike number one? And the argument against it being number one for me was like, burn versus the other two cards on this list. Burn has never been the best deck in the format and dominated the format. It's always been decent. Desperate Ritual is always, Lava Spike has always been a major card in that deck, but it's never been, Burn has never been just like the best deck in Modern, and it never really, I can't imagine a world where it will be that. And if it does get to that point, I think what happens is they print something better than Lava Spike and Lava Spike gets removed.
Burn is always, there's almost always one Burn in like a top 8 or a top 16. Like, almost always there's one. And at least, and also, if you look at like metagame rankings, it's always like right around the top 10. If it's not like the ninth deck, it's the 12th, or sometimes it'll get as high as like the seventh deck in some formats, but it's always there.
And part of that is it's always serviceable to play. It's also like one of the more budget decks that's always serviceable to play. So it's always going to have its proponents. There's also just like burn aficionados, right? There are people that just want to light people's face on fire, and that's totally great. Like the Blitz decks were the one time that mono red burn esque decks, but those are really tempo decks, right? It's like a tempo aggro deck versus a burn deck, so it's hard. And Lava Spike wasn't playing those really, so
you just get used to playing that way and counting your damage. So yeah, now we round out our trio here. You actually dropped it just a second ago on accident, our trio of red cards, and this one is Desperate Ritual. Red one, instant, right? This one's an instant. Yeah, it is. Add red to your mana pool. And this one also is another splice onto arcane card, correct?
This is an arcane card with splice on the arcane one in red. Significantly more relevant on this card than the other two arcane cards we mentioned, right? Because you can have two copies of Desperate Ritual and splice onto the first copy of Desperate Ritual with the second one in your hand, and that generates a very significant amount of mana and is done in Storm pretty regularly.
Yeah, so that, I mean, There's Desert Ritual, and then there's also the other one, which is Pyretic Ritual. And they're the same card, minus obviously all the Spice and Arcane stuff, but it's still red one for three red. And they're kind of collectively together the reason that you're able to play the thing we talked about, Gifts Ungiven, and stack your deck and have the different, you know, it's the fact that you have two of those. It's funny that like Storm continues to be as good as it is over the years and is so resilient, because the format started with Rite of Flame, which is red. It's from Cold Snap. It costs one red and it's add red to your mana pool. And then it's plus an additional red, I think, for each copy of Rite of Flame in your graveyard. That was banned from the second it started. Then a few years later, when Burn was good, they banned red to add five, right? Seething Songs, that's gone. But still, despite all that, we managed to still have a very good Burn deck, or a very good Storm deck.
Like right now in my head, Grape Shot and Primeval Titan are in a race neck to neck to have the most cards banned in Modern. Right,
yeah,
like
true.
It's like one of those two cards has gotten cards banned and a lot of them, and you know, the majority is out of the Storm deck, because when Storm is the best deck in the format, Wizards has to ban a card, like almost always. And Desperate Ritual has seen play through that whole era, all of those eras. This card is being a key part of those decks. It's just one of the best ritual effects in the format, arguably the best ritual in the format, depending on what you think Manamorphose is, and like as a key part of Storm. It's like we'll always like, and we'll until it gets banned or until Storm gets put into the ground, this card will see play, and Storm will consistently see play even when it's bad by players, and will win tournaments because it is one of those I'm a ship passing you in the night, and sometimes I'm just gonna beat you. Also, it is one of the most affordable tier 2.5 and above decks in the format, so new players can get into it, master Storm, which is not that hard. It sounds hard on paper, right? If you're a new player, Storm sounds like one of the most difficult decks ever played. But it's also the easiest to learn by gold fishing. And so it becomes a deck that is pretty easy to pick up with a little practice.
I think the reason when you say that, because I think somebody listening, and a lot of you guys know this, but I think somebody listening might not really quite understand, like, why when Storm is good, does it have to be banned? And the reason it's something has to be banned over, say, like, let's just say Burn. Like, Burn's a good example of where you're counting damage. And it's like, okay, I'm at this number, I have this much mana. If I draw my next card and it's the card I'm waiting for, I will win, right? A lot of decks have that, where it's like my combo piece, I win. The difference between those decks and Storm is that Storm is constructed in such a way where you could, your chips could be down. You could be far away from the win. They could have already shut down your plan once. But number one, your discard pile, your graveyard, right? Like stuff you've used already, is a significant relevant part of the Storm deck. So just because you've tried once and all those pieces are in your graveyard, if you get the right thing going, your graveyard's just as relevant. So unless they want to, like, they can't nuke that. That's part of Magic. And then on top of that, Storm is constructed of hand sculpting cantrips. That's what it's built out of. So like your one card you draw is a card that's going to let you see more cards. And as soon as you see more cards, can dig you further into seeing more cards. So your one card ultimately just opens up this cascade. And if the critical mass reaches in design where, like, basically it's like I have a higher percentage of winning based on my deck than your deck, and you could stop me, but I'm not doing anything other than just trying to combine the cards in this deck over like one turn to win. My percentage is high. If you let me untap, I might just draw the card that's going to win me the game. And right, you can't like accurately stop that from happening in the same way that you can with a lot of other strategies.
It's also boring AF to watch someone play the second time. Like, if you play in a Magic tournament, the first time you play against a Storm deck, it's kind of cool. You're like, oh man, they either failed and you were able to beat them, great, or they like kill you and you're like, that was cool. Watching Storm one time do its thing is a cool thing that is possible in Magic. The eighth time you play against a Storm deck in a tournament, you want to blow your brains out. It's like it is a tedious experience where you're having to count and you have to pay attention to what your opponent's doing. It goes for a while, you don't get to do anything, and it has a little bit of the eggs problem as well, where your opponents will run out the clock in a way, but then once you go to turns, every turn they need to go for it, and because of that they could take an extra 10 minutes every turn for three of those turns, adding 30 minutes to every round if Storm is a pretty significant deck in the format. So like, that's a problem. It's pretty unfun. It's hard to interact with, as you said, and Wizards hates it.
Yeah, no, great, but not enough Not enough to kill it, though, because there are ways they could have killed it by now.
I don't think they could kill it. I think if they get rid of Grapeshot, you play with Aetherflux Reservoir, like you would have to do some pretty significant. Mind you, they have tried, right? They got rid of the Seething Sod. They got rid of, Gitaxian. They've gotten rid of Storm cards in the past. And it always comes down to there's always going to be something else that exists that you can play with it. And they don't want to murder it entirely because it is a really fun, cool piece of magic that a lot of people love. And you need something for everyone. And I think getting rid of all Storm variability would be a bad idea.
I think you could probably kill it. I don't know if you could kill it with one card, though. Because I agree with you, Grapeshot would be probably the biggest hit.
I think they should ban Grapeshot.
Yeah.
But that's, I'm less on that now, but in the past I've argued for it. Not because I think Grapeshot is Storm is so good that they need to get rid of a card for, but I think there's a lot of cards on the ban list that don't need to be banned if Grapeshot is banned, and the Storm deck doesn't go away. You just play Aetherflux Reservoir and you main deck. You now add green, you play Chatterstorm, you play the goblin version of it, which I'm forgetting.
Right, and play the Warrens.
Yeah, now with Chatterstorm, Grapeshot, kind of a mute point, right? They just add green, which I think would maybe be good for the deck. It does, honestly,
slower because you have to get creatures out of it.
The biggest argument against that, personally, is it makes the deck significantly more expensive, which I think would be a net negative. Because
you have no more colors.
Yeah, you'd have to play with Fetchlands right now, right? Right now, Storm is one of the few decks that Fetchlands actually make the deck worse. And so you just don't you want to play pain lands and other lands that are just going to do better for you than the fetch mana base.
So that brings us to our top two, and our number two card is a card that has been wrecking the format since basically it first started being played, which is crazy. Well, and
it was a banning, right? Like a banning put this card into power level, because before that there was a more powerful card than it legal that made the decks that were playing it more explosive. It got banned about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years
arguably
ago.
Arguably more powerful. I mean, more powerful for that deck, I think. More powerful specifically for
other decks. Other decks have not played this card. This card sees play in one specific deck. That deck has been a very good deck for 5 years and is consistently in the top tier of decks in the format, but it's not so the card's Azusa.
Azusa Lost with Seeking.
So 2 and a green for a 1/2 legendary creature. You may play 2 additional lands each turn. Which is probably third place in most cards I've cast on this list after Gothly Prison and Sakura Tribe Elder. But this card is famously one of the key pieces to Amulet Titan decks, right? Like it's now, and the card that got banned before this card was printed was Summer Bloom. And when Summer Bloom was banned, people started playing Sakura Tribe Scout, which was in our honorable mentions, and this card in combination to make that deck work. This card consistently is one of the more important pieces to that. It benefits with more things, and it's a little bit more powerful and resilient, and it lets you go off.
It's a little less significant than it used to be alongside Dryad of the Elysian Grove. Like, that card pushed this deck forward, I think, a little further, unless I'm forgetting and naming the wrong card. But I seem to remember.
They see play together, though, because they do different things, but they are both important.
Right. Well, I mean, for sure. But I mean, like, the point is, this card allowing to play two lands is much better than the one that Dryad of the Elysian Grove allows you to. But the fact that you have another card that is getting you something pretty similar, but also does something else very, very good.
This is the card that, like, by untapping with it, by putting into play in turn 3, you're able to get the 2 lands into play that on turn 4, you're guaranteed going to be playing a Primeval Titan. And if it survives, you're playing a Primeval Titan plus getting 2 additional land drops with the bounce lands you're finding, which basically gives you the win. Where Sacred Tribe Scout doesn't let you jump the line that thoroughly, and neither does Dryad of the Elysian Grove. Dryad of the Elysian Grove does give you the jump on Valakut triggers, right? Like, it allows your Valakut to trigger one turn earlier because it makes Valakut into a mountain. But yeah, that's kind of the main difference.
Yeah, and this is a deck that over the years continues to, yeah, as you said, it evolves. You know, Tribe Scout started getting played a few years ago. Elysian Grove was a big card when it was printed. They continue to develop and evolve the deck. I mean, it's a lands-based deck, right? So as good lands get printed, the deck gets better. This is another one where it's not that fun to play against. I'm pretty tired of playing against this deck.
It's explosive enough that you get around it. I mean, I will say that also Arboreal Grazer has made Sacred Tribe Scout just like no longer relevant, right? The one mana, you really only need to get one of those enter the battlefield effects of getting a new land. Right.
That's the reason that card was there. I knew when I looked at it, I was like, this just like weird. Like, why am I, what am I like mixing up with this card? That's what it was. I forgot that Arboreal Grazer was such a big deal.
So like Azusa is like one of those really powerful things, you know, Dryad Elysian Grove and Arboreal Grazer have definitely dropped it down, but it still historically has been this powerful and continues to see play versus some of the other cards below, which like are in like weirder decks, right? Like that's the thing that's interesting about Kamigawa. It is a long list of powerful cards, but the most powerful ones have been banned and the other ones are kind of in this like role player role. And even our number one slot, which is going to be consistent. Like, so none of these cards have like in the past, they've reinvented the format or have been very defining features of the format. But now at this point in history, they're no longer really killing it in the same way.
For sure. I mean, I do think it's really interesting. I was prepared looking at this list to be like, God, this is such a trash block. So many underpowered cards. I was shocked at how many playable cards that have had a huge role in Modern were on this list. I honestly was very surprised. And they are almost all role players. Like there's very, very few cards on this entire list, in fact, that are just like just generically good. In fact, as I look at the list, it's almost like Gifts Ungiven is generically good and has been played over the years in a lot of different decks to different purposes, but it's still like that's like probably the one that feels the most other than the number one, which is has been around forever and we're getting to now. And the number one card, it gets better every year for obvious reasons. It like it's a card that exists and gets riffed on and other versions of this card get printed. Hate bear versions of this card. The card we're talking about is Pithing Needle. It is an artifact for one.
I did forget was originally printed in this set.
Yeah, one colorless artifact. And it's when it enters the battlefield, name a card. Activated abilities of the chosen card can't be activated. So it's a unique and interesting card. It goes a long way. It doesn't have any stipulation. Doesn't tell you that you can't name lands. So this card allows you to name the name of a fetch land, which means a fetch land cannot be activated. It obviously allows you to name any planeswalker. It allows you to shut down a ton of different things for years that way. And has been that way and continues to be good because there will always be powerful things that are printed. And the thing that's so significant about this card is because it's colorless and it costs one, it beats the curve against anything powerful that your opponent's doing in a very good deck that has an activated ability. If you're on the play and you know you need to stop something from happening, you bring this in out of the sideboard, any deck can play it. You play it on turn one, you name the thing, and your opponent just like sinks in their chair because like if you've gotten your shot off before them, now they have to try to answer this before doing their thing.
Right. And the big thing and like the major reason that this has moved from a thing that like 2 years ago, this would have been in the middle of the pack. I probably would have put it at number five. Everything else after that would have moved up a slot. Urza's Saga, on the other hand, has made this one of the most played cards in Modern. You know, they're like it, looking at just like the most recent decks it's seen playing. It sees playing Hammer Time, Jund, Amulet Titan, Rakdos Midrange, Hardened Scales, Mono Green Tron, Affinity, like Eldrazi Tron, right? Like anything that's getting away with playing an Urza Saga, Pithing Needle is on the top, like top five cards on the list that you look at to bring in or have in your main deck as a one of, because it's randomly always going to be decent. You're randomly going to get fetch lands. You're randomly going to get planeswalkers. You're randomly going to get different creatures with activated abilities like Ignoble Hierarch or, anything of that variety. So it's this like very versatile card that then you can play a one of in your deck that's tutorable by 4-year cards that you're going to be able to get it the turn you need it if you ever need it in a way that's basically uncounterable. So that's just shot it up to me to being just like one of the most important cards of the format, where before it was more of like a role player and now it's like, oh, this card is weirdly seeing play everywhere.
Look, I mean, if you're going to do something relevant in Modern, there are a couple of different barometers. How cheap are you, right? How cheap are you? Do you cost one? Do you cost zero? If you cost one or zero, you have a pretty good chance to be pretty ubiquitous. Are you colorless? If you're good and you cost one and you're colorless, it's difficult to imagine that over the years you won't just become more and more relevant. I think that's why this card is where it is now. Is like, as you said, Urza Saga, that card's from the last year, right? Right. Like, so They've reprinted Pithing Needle all over the years a ton of times. Like I said, there have been creature versions of this card. Classically, Phyrexian Revoker from New Phyrexia is one of my favorites. The 2-1 Hatebearer version of Pithing Needle. But this card is a classic, you know. And
the fact that it's findable by Urza's, like the fact that and Trinket Mage and other things, right? Like, I've always loved the fact that you can Trinket Mage for this card, but like, we're now at the point where Trinket Mage is on a land and it's like bonkers, and here we are, and it's dope. So the last thing, anything else on the top 10? Because I do want to go one last section before we finish off the podcast.
No, go ahead.
All right. So I asked the internet. So, you know, this is a little bit of a look back. Those are the top 10 cards. We didn't talk too much about the mechanics of the format. You know, the whole block had Bushido, Channel, Epic, Ninjutsu, Offering, Soul Shift, Splice, Sweep, Flip, flip cards, and Arcane. I think of those, Ninjutsu is like often heralded as one of the most popular, with like also the rider that it being ninja themed is a mistake. Like, it's the best mechanic that is so specific in who gets to use it that it's been really weird to find homes for it. It's another mechanic that I would be very surprised isn't in the next set. Bushido to me is like on the other side, where it's like, this is a really cool keyword that belongs to a really cool tribe, but that makes every one of them really boring, because it's just like you get a power and toughness boost when you do attacking and blocking for like a tribe that I wish was a lot cooler. But I there's like a lot of really cool stuff that like from this set, it's like a lot of really satisfying, as I mentioned, versions of mechanics. And I am excited to see what we get back and what we see in Neon. But I did ask the internet on Twitter, what is your favorite and least favorite things from the original Kamigawa block? And I'm going to go through some of the tweets. The first one is from Alex, who is at Baneslayer Angel. She says the favorite is the Spirit Tribal. It was the first set that really did Spirit Tribal. And her least favorite was the crappy mechanics like Epic and Sweet.
Sweep.
So for those who don't know, Sweep is... requires you to return some number of a specific type of basic land card to your hand as they resolve, and then the rest of the effects rely on how many you bring back does a thing. So like an example is return any number of planes you control your hand, target creature gets +1/+1 until end of turn for each planes returned this way. It's based on the fact that there was a tribe Moonfolk from the set that their whole theme was returning lands back to your hand, and it was playing into the, like, there was a whole mechanic about doing that and then using those lands.
Yeah, I mean, some of the design with that stuff is absurd. I agree that Sweep is really bad.
Yeah, and then Epic was their first take on legendary instants and sorceries, which honestly I like this a lot better than I like legendary, what we got for legendary instants and sorceries. But both are bad, and that is it's a massive expensive spell, 7 mana, 10 mana, 6 mana, I think, for the black one, which is on the short smaller
Enduring end. Ideal is the most famous one,
I believe, and it's once you cast it for the rest of the game, you are no longer to cast new spells, but at the beginning of your upkeep, this spell recasts itself. So you're no longer casting spells. This spell just gets repeated. Enduring Ideal is the one that search your library for an enchantment card and put into play, then shuffle your library. So you just get a new enchantment every turn for free, and then you no longer get to cast spells. Not the best mechanic. But yeah, Spirit Tribal is dope.
Spirit Tribal is great. And yeah, and I mean, and that's like, it's one of the things that I think is the most fun about it, where spirits over the years became a little bit more centric on, like, you know, ghouls and ghosts and things like that, like blue and white, like became very, very like spirit kind of colors. Mm-hmm. This set had like spirit as a major part of it, right? You had them in every color. Spirits weren't flying 1/1s. They were colorless 1/1s. So there was something fun about that, I think.
Right. Next, we have rebel.ai or at sunrebel on Twitter, another Magic YouTuber. Also really recommend her channel. It's really great. She does really great CDH content and other content. And she said the good thing was the artwork and just like how gorgeous all the artwork is, which I do definitely agree. The set looks amazing. It has a strong like Japanese folklore plus Miyazaki esque vibe to it, which I really love. And then her negative was the power and toughness on the creatures, which I don't actually know off the top of my head if I was a fan or not. Like, that's that's something I feel like, you know, if you play limited. I will say all of the creatures we said we liked are like weirdly 1/1s and 2/2s for five, but I don't have strong opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of 1/1s. There's like a ton of just, I mean, I think like my, like I said at the beginning of this episode, like one of the major things that I definitely remember was just like how many trash commons and uncommons there were. There are some cool ones, but like the cards, like the limited environment's not great. It's like definitely just very, very, very weak. Not very, very, doesn't feel like you're casting exciting things very often.
Next is at Tupin's Gallery. Favorite was Legendary Dragons and the flip cards. Least favorite was Splice onto Arcane and Soul Shift. Yeah, we didn't really talk about the Legendary Dragons, mostly because they're more of like a EDH kind of featured thing. And in fact, one of them was banned in EDH for a long time, the black one. And they're just like a cycle of dragons that when they died, gain an effect, and it was do a bunch of damage, mind control, drain for five and gain that much life, tap or target opponent doesn't untap on their next turn. And the green one that I don't have any idea what that card does.
Yeah, I don't recall right offhand. I opened one in a pack recently. They put them, I think they were put into the third.
No, they were first. They were like the five color cycle that was in modern
Masters one.
I think they were.
They put them in another set. They put them in another set. Like they might. Oh, I think they were probably in one of the like ultimate or like double.
They were in iconic masters as well.
Iconic masters. That's what it was.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Because they're pretty iconic cards. They're the first time you had dragons in all five colors, which was outside of the elder dragons. So that was like they were always really popular. Least, we already talked Splice on Arcane. I am excited for Splice. I think the Arcane part of that feature is what made that mechanic hard to deal with. And then Soul Shift, which for those who don't know, because we didn't go over Soul Shift yet, is...
It has like a number, like Soul Shift 1 or Soul Shift 4.
Yeah, and so when this creature dies, Soul Shift 7, when this creature dies, you may return target spirit card with converted mana cost less than the number from your graveyard to your hand. This is a mechanic that I feel like would be really, really cool if they made it with today's technology and understanding of power and toughnesses and effects and numbering and balancing. At the time, I think it's just like on a lot of bad cards.
I agree with you. I think that if done correctly, they might have to change... I don't know if Soul Shift for spirits is like what this should be, but I think they could take this idea and I think they could probably apply this somewhere in a really cool way, would be my guess.
This is from Ryan Sanio at Ryan Sanio. Love Samurai and Black Aligned Protagonist. I will agree, this is one of the few times in Magic history where the main character that was the hero was a black aligned character. Normally black is the villain color. And then Samurai were really cool, other than I hated the Bushido mechanic. And then they hated the hand size matter themes and saviors. That's where sweep came from, making your hand as large as possible, which was just like, I think we had, we got lunch over the break with Andrew Brown, and he was talking about like some of his least favorite mechanics, and sweep was one of them. And or the hand size matters part of Kamigawa Block was his like least favorite thing, because it just like was don't do anything, no longer cast spells, the mechanic.
Nobody's mentioned snakes. Nobody, we didn't talk about it on the show at all. It didn't, there was, right? I thought snakes were popular. I thought people loved snakes. Maybe not.
Yeah, no, I'm real. That's one of the things I'm really excited about going to Neon Kamigawa is just all the creature types. Like that was, I think, my favorite. If I'm going to pick one of my favorite things in retrospect about Kamigawa Block, it's the creature types. Rat folk, snake folk, the fox, you know, the fox folk, the spirit tribal. I love spirit tribal in general.
Eight like tails I'm or a, whatever that card is called.
Blue white, Innistrad, guys, the St. Traft boy. I'm excited for... Like that's the thing that I like always. And then, you know, even the, like the class, like Samurai Ninjutsu, all of that stuff, I think is like really dope. And I am excited for it. I'm also excited for more shrines. Like we didn't talk about the Honden, which was like one of the coolest, the few times I've played them in limited were when they were part of Eternal Masters. And they were like one of my favorite versions of that draft format was the Honden. So I'm excited.
They're great they're great for limited. They were never powerful enough.
And then they got reprinted recently, right? In the core set, they were really good.
Yeah. They redid shrines. Exactly. Yeah. Sanctum of Shattered Heights, Sanctum of Fruitful Harvest.
Played them a lot on Arena. Even that's one of the reasons I played with them so much, is that was like the height of me drafting on Arena. So This one's from Shivam Bhatt, friend of the cast. Also, I'm going to be on his podcast soon. This is just a way to shout out people. Favorite is Azusa, number three on the list, number two on the list. And then least favorite was how badly the packs perform in Chaos Draft.
Yes, true. True. And they're not cheap packs either, guys. Like, to put in perspective for you how insanely expensive some of these packs are, the fact that an Oboro, it's just at rare, a foil Oboro is almost $400. The fact that you can open that is just all of those lands, all the rare lands, if you open them in foil, are like $60 to $100. They're actually like shockingly expensive packs to get now. I mean, they're old, but like for as like disliked as the sets kind of are overall, I'm shocked at like actually how in demand the cards are. Like we've never, almost never played with a Kamigawa pack in a Chaos Draft. Well,
they're also like the value isn't very high. Like there's a few cards you could open, but the cards right. that are worth money are like Jite is the only card in the entire set that's worth anything. And so it's like not worth the money you're paying for. It's like bad at every angle.
Well, no. I mean, so I don't actually know which cards were from which set. So maybe that is the case with Jite. What I was saying is like the cards that are worth a lot are worth a ton. And like,
sure.
because they're old and there's actually a pretty high number of them, the packs themselves end up getting really expensive.
It's pretty insular though. I think like the number of rares that are worth a lot is really low. Like the chances of opening the card that's worth a lot of money is really low. And that's why they're so expensive, right? Like you have two cards worth $50 in Saviors of Kamigawa, and then every other card is trash.
I mean, kind of, but like, check this out. I'm just really quickly going to just rifle through some of the foil prices, because like, obviously, if you open foils and they're
foil is like sure. not that's even worse, right? You have a one in a box chance of opening up a foil rare.
Sure, but like, just bear with me for a second, because this is what I was blown away by. Like, Sakura Tribe Scout is a $27 foil. Tribe Elder is a $13 foil. Azusa is a $140 foil. Kiki is a $160. Lava Spike is $21. Pithing Needle is 66.
That's why I get it, but like foils are a useless barometer for like that. That's my point, right? Is like the only way to get value is the luck sack out of it. You're not like, it's not like opening World Wake packs where, or like it's not like there's a fetch land cycle in there where like you have a likelihood to open up $30 regardless. Like one of every five packs has a fetch.
I'm saying you'd be surprised if you look at the prices of these cards. You'd be more.
What's the non-foil top five cards? Dollars. Foil like is high. Useless to me.
Okay, like I'll rifle through a couple of the prices. Just things that are like reasonably expensive. Kiki is $13. Needle is $13. Bosiju is $33. Oboro is $85. Araya was 10, Kataki is 16, you got 25 for Glimpse of Nature, 60 for Sensei's Divining Top.
But that's top's the big one. Well, that's Champions of Kamigawa.
Uncommon.
Right?
Yeah. Jite is 26, Castle is 14, Forbidden Orchard's 20, Hall of Bandit Lord is 24.
Saviors. I have them
all together. The point I'm just saying because everything's at rare. For the most part, you don't have to hope you open a mythic rare to open like a money card. I don't think the value is there. I'm just saying like when you do open them in Chaos, there are plenty of things that you can randomly open that are worth like a lot of money. And we both know the way that it works is the price of the pack foil is ultimately what determines the price of an old vintage pack. It's the fact that you could open this mint pack foil. And it always, the cost of the pack always ends up being slightly more than whatever perceived value. That's just how they're priced. So like they're very expensive for, you know, you could hit the lottery, but also a lot of the cards are trash. Most of them are trash.
Sure. The last thing to bring up, and someone, it was Anna MT 1992. She actually just had a least favorite, and that is whatever this is, I can't read upside down text. And it's in reference to Initiate of the Blood and Goka of the Unjust, but it's specifically flip cards. And I think this is like a weirdly stratifying mechanic. I actually loved flip cards when I started. I like love messing around with the magic border and like what the card can do. I agree that the flip cards were super confusing, and the new technology of flip cards, the actual flip cards, are a significantly superior way of doing transformation effects. But I like that this is the first time they tried doing it.
I hate the flip cards from Kamigawa. They're in my top. I cannot tell you the sheer number of times when, like, thumbing through a database to try to find cards for a deck, I've come across the same Kamigawa flip cards and been like, which one is this one? I don't even want to bother reading. I'm just going to skip it entirely. Like, there's three black ones, there's three white ones, or whatever.
Right. I will say they made a big, in my opinion, the big mistake they made, and it's like the lesson learned, right, is that they like tap.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Why do any of them tap? I think like if all of them were creature that maybe could tap, right, a creature on the top end, and then always flipped into an enchantment or something along those lines, which some of them do. Those are the ones that are fine to me, because they like be, you're never confused about what you're looking at. But the fact that you have like creatures that flip into creatures and both of them have tap abilities, how the hell are you supposed to know actually what side's supposed to be the face up one? And that's bad.
Agreed.
All right, that is the last section of this podcast. That is it today. The big thing is, like, I'm super hyped for the next set. I think a lot of the issues with Kamigawa block have more to do with the like design lessons that have definitively been learned since then, right? Like, don't like the like concept of parasitic mechanics came from the failures of the set. The concept of Azfan and the legendary mechanic came from the failures of the set. The legendary mechanic and how it worked has been drastically changed and modified and become a much more significant part of the game. Like, there's all of these small things that at the time I think were a lot worse that Wizards has just learned lessons on, and that does give them the opening to come back and do ninjas in a cool way, do samurai in a cool way, do snake tribal in a cool way, do spirits and kami in like a old versus new vibe that I'm really excited by.
Yeah, I'm really excited for Nina Dynasty. I think it looks like a great set. And I mean, more than even the design of the cards themselves, I just like the theme a lot. So
sure.
I have a lot of nostalgia for the good parts of Kamigawa, just like Marvel is doing with old things. And, you know, bringing back the old good stuff is great. So we won't have to deal with the old bad stuff, and we can just bring back the stuff that's awesome. And that'll be that.
So now that we're excited for Neon Kamigawa, would you be excited for a Lorwyn return? Where are you on the Lorwyn stuff?
Oh, way more, because I don't like Kamigawa, and I love Lorwyn.
Okay.
Lorwyn block was like a time I played a lot of Magic. Like, you bring me back some Kithkin, or, you know, you bring me back some of that stuff, like, I'm all about it. Like, I played a lot of Lorwyn and Morningtide and Shadowmoor and Eventide. Those were all sets that I
was pretty invested in. Of all the sets we haven't revisited, which one would you want to revisit the most? Like Kaldheim, Lorwyn, Ikoria, Shards of Alara, Tarkir. Muldrotha,
great question. That is. Yeah, because all the old sets, like the really old sets, they're all technically Dominaria, right? We didn't start to get off of Dominaria for a while,
which we're going back to, and we're going to go to like Wrath and stuff. We're getting the Brothers War, so that's going to be dope.
Yeah, that's going to be cool. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Some of the stuff, nothing you named like jumped out at me as like something that I like desperately want to see.
So could be Lorwyn. Your answer could be Lorwyn and Shadowmoor.
Yeah. I guess the fact that we haven't gone back there to me is, you know, and yeah, probably it is then, because I had a real attachment to those sets.
Yeah, I think it's Tarkir for me, but they're pretty close beyond that. And maybe Alara would be the third. Like, those three places are like, Tarkir is fascinating that we haven't returned. Like, that set was so popular for us not to have gone back. And it's partially, I think, just because there's not a story to tell there, really. And so there needs to be a reason to go back in story.
I mean, that set came out when I joined the podcast with you, right? I mean, that was 8 years ago, eight years ago.
Our set review was Tarkir. So, yeah, it's of all of the sets that based on popularity versus lack of return, that's the one that's like the most wild to me.
Agreed, yeah.
The Shadowmoor Lorwyn, I think, especially if Kamigawa does well, I could see happening. That's another one that has a lot of people pushing for. The difference between Shadowmoor and Lorwyn and Tarkir, I think, and the reason people are asking for them differently is Rosewater has said on paper that set was unpopular. We are unlikely to return versus Lorwyn. Tarkir, which is like, no, that set was popular, eventually we'll get back. And I think the mistake that he has always made is whenever he says you can't have something or you're not going to get it,
people want it back.
Like, yeah. I want it.
A lot of the stuff in Lorwyn that was really popular, we've gotten in different ways, I think, you know, over the years. They've given us, like, a lot of the stuff that people like from Lorwyn, we've actually gotten in other places. lot of like we've gotten a lot of hybrid mechanic.
I was going to say, I'm realizing we should maybe do this as a whole episode. So I'm going to pause us here on this conversation because going over all of the stuff that we haven't returned to and talking about if we'd want to go back to those worlds sounds really dope. So future episode coming out probably after Kamigawa or maybe during it. Maybe it's what we talk about next week. Who knows? But beyond that, once again, thank you, patrons. Thank you for supporting this podcast. You're the reason it can happen. Thank you, Time Travel Media, for editing this podcast and making it happen as well with the help of those patrons. Thank you, TCG Player. Once again, if you can, click the link below you can do we get a kickback and it costs you nothing on TCGPlayer.com. Make sure to check out Battle Bosses. It's a game that is out now. We're finally shipping all of the Kickstarter backers should have their copies of the game. It's out in the world. If you go to BattleBosses.com, it's a game that I invented, created, kickstarted, and now I'm shipping. Ben helped a lot with the design and testing early on in the process and during the process is a big, big part of it. And it's now coming out. So definitely check it out. There's also a YouTube channel. If you search Battle Bosses, you can see different boss breakdowns of each of the bosses. Definitely make sure to check that out. And it's super appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Thank you so much for hanging with us once again. We'll be back next week with another episode. And 8 years later. Thanks for hanging with us.
Thanks, everyone. Talk to you next week. Hit that subscribe button.
This has been a production of Time Traveler Media, sending podcasts into the future.